We're going to start off in Mark 12, so if you have a Bible, turn or click, or whatever your preferred method is. It's verses 28 to 31. What's just happened before this is some teachers of the law, the Jewish law, have come up to Jesus and they are questioning him. They're trying to find a way to get him arrested. But this one teacher has seen that he's answering questions pretty well, so he decides to ask him this one. One of the teachers of the law came and heard them debating. Noticing that Jesus had given them a good answer, he asked him, "Of all the commandments, which is the most important?" "The most important one," answered Jesus, "is this: Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. The second is this: Love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these." So I've actually given this talk a title, but I'm not going to tell you what that is. Yeah, it's a lyric from a Mumford & Sons song. I don't know if anyone's a fan of Mumford & Sons. They're sort of like a folk pop band. And I was listening to it the other day, and there's just one line in it that I think kind of sums up exactly what I'm trying to say this morning. But I'll let you know what that is at the end. And if you guess it, well, don't have to let me know afterwards. The question we're looking at is, where do we invest? Where do we invest? What is it that we should pour our everything into? And what should we be investing in? I was just interested to see what Jesus says on that matter. And there's a good illustration of it later on in Mark 12. And that's from verse 41 and then carries on into Mark 13, verse 2. So if we just read that one through as well. After that, he's been asked this question. He's still in the temple and he's spoken in the temple. And he sits down and he's watching people come in and they're bringing offerings. Jesus sat down opposite the place where the offerings were put and watched the crowd putting their money into the temple treasury. Many rich people threw in large amounts, but a poor widow came and put two very small copper coins, only worth a few pence. Calling his disciples to him, Jesus said, "Truly, I tell you, this poor widow has put more into the treasury than all the others. They gave out of their wealth, but she, out of her poverty, put in everything, all she had to live on." As Jesus was leaving the temple, one of the disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what massive stones, what magnificent buildings." "Do you not see all these great buildings?" replied Jesus. "Not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down." You've probably heard that story before. People often emphasize how the woman gave everything, which was amazing, and it's an incredible example of giving. And that's exactly what I mean by investing. It's putting our everything into something. However, where it finishes at the end of chapter 12 doesn't quite tell the whole story. There's another dimension to it that we can sometimes miss because of the chapter breaks. And this happens quite a lot, particularly in the New Testament, because originally it was written in Greek. It was written in Koine Greek, and they didn't have any sort of structure or paragraphing in Greek. So you literally start reading the gospel and there's a sentence and you keep going to the next sentence and it just keeps going until you get to the end of the gospel and there's no structure in it whatsoever. So the chapters and the verses were put in to help us sort of navigate around the Bible, which is really helpful. But sometimes it means we just miss something that the author might want us to see. And this is one of those cases, because the widow comes and she gives everything that she has, but she's investing it in a place that's going to be thrown down, as Jesus says a few verses later. So although she's giving as we should give, he's saying, no, the temple isn't the place to give this anymore. And this is because when Jesus came, it signifies a transition of covenants. So the Old Testament, there was a covenant that God gave to Abraham, "I will be your God and you will be my people." And he gave these laws and commandments. Everything was centered around the temple in order to try and keep that relationship. And in the Old Testament law, what the widow was doing, giving her everything to the temple, would have been fantastic. But although she's giving right, the temple is no longer the emphasis. That's not where Jesus wants us to invest. So where is it that we should invest? Jesus tells us that as his disciples. And the first thing he says to his disciples, the ones in the Gospels, the 12 disciples, when he meets them is, come and follow me. Come and follow me. And in Jewish culture at the time, if you were a disciple, you would go to a rabbi who was a teacher of the law. And it was only if you were like very highly academically qualified, you could go to this rabbi and he'd decide whether or not he thought you were good enough to be his disciple. And if you did, then you'd follow him. And this was a big thing. It's what a lot of people aspired to. But it's not quite the same as the student-teacher relationship that we know. It wasn't about just going and listening and gaining knowledge and taking notes. It was about following the rabbi and wanting to become like the rabbi, so literally wanting to become exactly like him and doing exactly what he does. So people would leave everything they have and completely devote their life to the rabbi in hope of becoming like them and becoming a rabbi themselves. And there was a phrase that developed, which Rob Bell talks about in one of the NEMA videos at the time, and it was this: may you be covered in the dust of your rabbi. And this was because people would walk so closely to the rabbi. This was the idea that if they're following them so closely, when they're walking along the dusty roads, they would get all the dust from the rabbi all over them. So they'd be so closely mimicking them that they'd just be covered in their dust and completely then, figuratively, immersed in their teachings and becoming more and more like them. So for the disciples following Jesus, that's the same kind of thing. They're following him really closely and they're mimicking him and hoping to be like him. And he gave them instructions, as a rabbi would. And they're for us too, as Jesus' disciples. And those instructions can be summed up in kind of two main things, which are the Great Commission and the two greatest commandments. Great Commission and the two greatest commandments. So the Great Commission can be found at the end of Matthew. And that says, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything that I've commanded you. But we're going to focus on the two greatest commandments this morning, because I think they answer the question of where we should invest. And those are, as we started off, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. And when I read that, the first thing I want to know is what love actually is. What is it that we're meant to do in that situation? Because we use the word love quite flippantly in English. There's not really a day that goes by without me saying, oh, I'd love a cup of tea. It's not that kind of love that Jesus is talking about, that sort of craving, mild fancy. Equally, it's not the kind of love that the world might tell us about, love that's completely based on feelings, on those butterflies in your stomach or something, you're swept off your feet and you can't control it. It's non-voluntary. That's also not what Jesus means here. The Greeks actually had loads of different words for all the different types of love. And that's really helpful when we're reading this, because we can work out kind of what type of love Jesus was talking about. And the Greek word was agape. Agape. It's often defined as a self-sacrificing love, a love that puts others first. But I think if you want the best definition of agape, it's in 1 Corinthians 13. And Paul tells us, he gives us a long list of all the qualities of agape love. And those are these: love is patient and kind. It does not envy and it does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It's not self-seeking, nor easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. It does not delight in evil. It rejoices with the truth. It always protects. It always trusts. It always hopes. It always perseveres, and it never fails. And if we want an example of that definition of agape, that's in Jesus. He's the ultimate example. He laid down his life for the sake of others, and others that could do nothing for him. So we're to follow his example in that. Watch what Jesus does. Read the Gospels, listen to him, and work out what that agape love is and see it in action. But the other thing about agape love is it's a choice. It's not something that just comes. You have to choose to act agape love. It's a decision. It's an attitude. And that's what Jesus is saying when he says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. So the word heart here has other definitions. So the word heart in Greek is cardia, but that can also, it means like the seat of your physical and spiritual life. So we're to apply all those qualities from 1 Corinthians to our physical lives and our spiritual lives and our day-to-day and the way we pray. And then soul, that can be the seat of your affections and your will. So we need to apply all those qualities to our physical lives and our spiritual lives and all our affections and our will, the decisions we make and the way that we treat people. And our mind, that's the seat of our understanding and our reasoning. So in the way that we make decisions, in the way that we think things through in logic, we've also got to apply it to that. And strength, that just means ability or might. So with everything we have to apply all those qualities. That patient, kind, does not envy, does not boast, is not proud, does not dishonor others, is not self-seeking, is not easily angered, it keeps no record of wrongs, does not delight in evil, rejoices with the truth, protects, trusts, hopes, perseveres, never fails. And we have to apply that to our physical life, our spiritual life, our affections and our will and all of our logic, and do that with all our ability and all of our might. It's a choice to apply these qualities to those things. So that's what we are to invest in. But how do we put that love into action? The first commandment is to love the Lord your God. So love God. Maybe that one's a bit more obvious. We can love God through prayer, through worship, and spending time with him in the way that we live, giving him glory, giving him thanks, and coming to know him and seeking after him. Because when we become Jesus' disciples and we give our everything to him, we become transformed. We become like a new creation. And as we do that, we grow and we become ever more like him. You see, God is love. As it says in 1 John 4, God is love, and Jesus is God revealed. So Jesus is the perfect example of what love looks like in a human life. But it's more than just copying. When we come to know Jesus, we are transformed to become more like him. And it makes sense of the verse later on in John 4, which says, we love because he loves us first. So God loves us with his agape love, and then we can learn to love him in that way too. But it's not just loving God and God loving us. The second commandment's there, and it's just as important, is to love your neighbour as yourself. And it's the same love that we have for God and that he has for us, the agape love that we have to love other people with, the community that's around us. We have to choose to love other people that way, which links in to the Great Commission. And love is life-changing. It's what everyone really longs for. And God's love even more so. It's the only complete version of love. It's incredible and renewing and transforming. There's a lyric in a song which I used to hear on UCB radio a few years ago, and I don't really know the song, but it's always stuck in my head. And it says this, it says, my life wasn't changed by an argument. That never would have been enough. My life was changed by the evidence of love. And I think that's very true. Love, knowing God's love, is the thing that changes people's hearts. You can have all the arguments you want, but that's the thing that's going to be life-changing. I have a friend who I've known since before Christmas. But just after Christmas, a mutual friend of ours came to me who was a Christian and said, oh, my friend's got all these questions about Christianity. I was like, oh, cool. And she was like, yeah, you study theology. I was like, yes, I do. Can you talk to her for me? I was like, okay. So I ended up meeting up with her, and we went for kind of loads of long walks down beaches and things, and she just grilled me on everything, which initially was a very strange relationship, because she was just asking me all these questions, and I was trying my best to answer them. I didn't have all the answers for all of them, but I was doing my best. But over time, it became less like that, and the more time I spent with her, the more we just chatted about life and what she likes doing, And so we just got chatting, we got spending time together, and soon we were meeting up, and we didn't even talk about God. We just spoke, we just spent time together because we really, really enjoyed each other's company. And then she started coming to church with me. And she's not a Christian, but she started coming to church. And I was a bit confused. I was like, we haven't spoken about God for a week. Why are you here? But she'd been thinking about what we'd spoken about. But I think what it was is that we'd formed a friendship. And we'd had this kind of way we were treating each other, this sort of love that then drew her to want to find more people like that within the church. And that felt she felt comfortable coming then because she was friends with me, not just seeking questions. And yeah, it's that value of that way of treating people that really changes people's hearts. The arguments may help, but that's never going to be what actually changes them. And I don't know about you, but it means so much when people show those little things of love. I have a friend, whenever I meet her, she always brings a bar of chocolate, which is lovely. She does it for all her friends, and it's great, but it means you really have to think about when you're going to meet her and kind of watch what you eat through the rest of the day, because you never know what she's going to turn up and bring. But it's a lovely thing that she does, and she does it for everybody, and she's like, no, I don't want anything back. I don't want it. I just want to give you this. It's these little things. There was a time my friend was having a really late night in the library. She'd overdue essay, like 12 hours sitting there trying to power this thing out. And I was in a coffee shop. I was like, oh, I'll take Eva a coffee. So I took her a coffee. And she spoke to me after. I didn't realise how much that actually meant to her, that someone had just taken the time to think and just put a little bit of effort in. And she came back with a flower for me and left it on my bed. But it was there, and she said, oh no, they had a bucket full of them outside the library. Someone had left them, saying, take it for someone that you really appreciate. And it just meant so much. And it's just little things, like people send me letters, and it's the best thing, because, I mean, letters are a bit of a treat nowadays. You know, you get postcards. Oh, someone's put in the time. Someone's actually thinking. Someone's actually caring. So it's little random acts of kindness. The little showing that you care that changes people. And that's what Jesus is talking about. Love your God in that way, but also love other people, because that's kingdom building. That's showing people more of God, and then they'll want to know more of God. It's a slightly different example of it in this book, The Case for Christ, which is by Lee Strobel. And the whole book is about arguments for God, and he evaluates all the Gospels, and it's very, very sort of like academic, very readable, but he speaks to these really kind of high people in academia. But there's a part in it where he's talking about someone that he knew, which kind of really shows that becoming a follower of Jesus was what changed him, not these arguments or whatever. For example, years ago, I knew a businessman who was a rabid racist with a superior and condescending attitude toward anyone of another colour. He hardly made any effort to conceal his contempt for African Americans, letting his bigoted bile frequently spill out in crude jokes and caustic remarks. No amount of arguments could dissuade him from his disgusting opinions. Then he became a follower of Jesus. As I watched in amazement, his attitudes, his perspective, and his values changed over time, and his heart was renewed by God. He came to realize he could no longer harbor ill will toward any person, since the Bible teaches that all people are made in the image of God. Today, I can honestly say that he's genuinely caring and accepting towards others, including those who are different from him. Legislation didn't change him. Reasoning didn't change him. Emotional appeals didn't change him. He'll tell you that God changed him from the inside out, decisively, completely, permanently. That's one of the many examples I've seen of the power of the gospel that Carson was talking about. The power to transform vengeful haters into humanitarians, hard-hearted hoarders into soft-hearted givers, power-mongers into selfless servants, and people who exploit others through slavery or some other form of oppression into people who embrace all. It's that love, again, that agape love, the love that is patient and kind and does not envy and does not boast and is not proud and does not dishonor others. It's not self-seeking or easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Does not delight in evil, rejoices with the truth, protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres, and never fails. So we need to invest in loving our God, in restoring our relationship with him, and having a strong relationship with him, because that's what he wants with us. But also we need to love our neighbour as ourselves, and that's about kingdom building. That's about extending God's love to go all over the earth, as Jesus tells us to do in the Great Commission as his disciples. Jesus can condense all that Old Testament law, all that temple and religion into these two commandments because Jesus came and he fulfilled the law. All that stuff which you couldn't do direct to God, it was always like through the temple and other things. It doesn't matter anymore because Jesus came and he showed this love. It means we can have a direct investment into God's relationship with us and into his kingdom. There's no need for that temple anymore. So what should we invest? We should invest our love. And we should do so wholeheartedly, giving everything as the widow did. And that Mumford & Sons quote, it's where you invest your love, you invest your life. Where you invest your love, you invest your life. Interestingly, from a song called Awake My Soul, which one of the main lines is, for you were made to meet your maker. So we need to pour everything into love, into our relationship with God and others. Because one is crucial to the other. That's why Jesus puts them together. You can't do one without the other. I'm just going to finish on a quote from one of my favorite people, Corrie ten Boom. It's not directly related, but it is. And just to give you food for thought on this. And it's this. Trying to do the Lord's work in your own strength is the most confusing, exhausting, and tedious of all work. But when you are filled with the Holy Spirit, then the ministry of Jesus just flows out of you. And I think you can substitute that in the case of love as well. So try and show the Lord's love in your own strength is the most confusing, exhausting, and tedious of all work. But when you are filled with his love, then the love of Jesus just flows out of you.